Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've been following this special series all week, you've heard some pretty dire stories. Cancer, extinction, job losses, tainted water, all of that against a backdrop of a growing climate crisis. I know that that can feel like a lot, so thank you, first of all, for your attention. Believe me when I say it can also feel horrible to report them. Day after day, one looming disaster after another. However, every once in a while, an idea comes to light that offers a glimpse of hope that shows us the power that we do have to change things. And in this case, in the case of one potential weapon in the climate fight, it doesn't even take a shiny new technology or a global lifestyle shift or the elimination of every political party that doesn't take climate change seriously. Those things would definitely help, but what can really power our fight to restore normalcy to our climate is knowledge. That's it, knowing where the world's most effective stores of carbon can be found, protecting them at all costs, and working to create more of them. None of that is rocket science. It's just regular science. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Welcome to the finale of our five-part series with the Narwhal. Today, we have Emma Gilchrist, editor-in-chief of thenarwhal.ca. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
First of all, thank you for sharing your publication stories with us. This has been a great week.
Yeah, we're delighted to share these stories. Thanks for having us.
And I'm glad that we can end it with this one because some of the stories may not have been as hopeful as what we're going to discuss today.
Yeah, this is a really fun one. You know, we report on a lot of the terrible things that are happening to the natural world in Canada on the Narwhal. But this series was such an opportunity to look at really systemic ways to protect nature.
And why don't we start with a couple of the terms that we're going to use today and go in depth on. Just maybe begin by explaining what is a nature-based climate solution. What does that mean?
Yeah, so a nature-based climate solution is basically, at its simplest form, just saying, let's not destroy our forests, our wetlands, our grasslands, and our farmlands. These are all ecosystems that contain massive amounts of carbon. And just by converting them by, you know, cutting them down or plowing them under, we're releasing a tremendous amount of carbon. So the whole idea of nature-based climate solutions is to keep those ecosystems intact or to restore them where possible.
And that release of carbon when we destroy some of these ecosystems, that's what you're referring to when you guys write about carbon caches, right? Can you unpack that a little bit for us? Explain the term.
Yeah, so we called the series Carbon Cache, and it was kind of like a fun play on words, which is really looking at, like, there are these huge deposits of carbon in Canada. If you look at a map, you see these huge deposits of soil carbon, you know, in areas that contain really dense old growth forests, for instance, or in areas that contain the peatlands and other wetlands in the boreal forest. And so really this series is looking at where those places are in Canada and what is being done to protect those ecosystems that contain massive amounts of carbon.
Before we get into each of them, can you explain the scale of that? What potential impact do they have collectively, both on Canada and on the world?
Yeah, so a study that came out in 2017 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that nature-based climate solutions could provide up to one-third of the reductions that the world needs to meet its 2030 climate targets. So that's a really huge chunk. And Canada's place in that Canada's home to 25% of the Earth's wetlands and boreal forests, as well as endangered grasslands. So we have a lot of intact ecosystems within Canada that just by protecting those, we could both be meeting conservation goals in Canada. Canada has a goal, you know, to protect 30% of its land and water by 2030. So we can meet those while at the same time, you know, keeping that carbon in the ground and helping to meet our climate targets.
When you say we could do that just by protecting them, what does that actually mean on the ground? You know, are we not protecting them now? Does this require legislation? Do we need to install regulations? Or, you know, where are we at with this, I guess?
Yeah, so for each different type of ecosystem, it's a little bit different. But let's look at grasslands, for instance. So a large proportion of Canada's grasslands have already been eradicated. That basically means that they have been, you know, cultivated for agriculture in various ways. When you till up that grassland, the roots of grasslands actually go a couple of meters underground, and you're releasing all of that carbon when you do that. And now the question is, how do we protect the remaining, you know, 20 to 25% of Canada's grasslands? And part of the way that you can do that is by actually valuing the carbon that is in the ground. And so something that's starting to happen now is that farmers and ranchers can actually earn revenue by keeping the carbon in the ground. So they're tapping into carbon markets and earning carbon credits for doing things like keeping grasslands. Instead of converting it into a more intensive form of agriculture, they can continue to graze cattle on those lands, for instance, and cattle grazing is actually good for grasslands. The grasslands developed to have grazing animals on them, originally bison. So by keeping those grasslands, farmers can now have a financial incentive to do so.
How do you put a price tag on that and who pays for it?
Yeah, so this is, you know, really kind of the billion-dollar question. Mm-hmm. But like in the case of grasslands, for instance, 1 hectare of grasslands holds up to 180 tons of carbon. That's about the equivalent of the emissions for a year from 39 cars. And 1 hectare is about the size of a Canadian football field. So imagine you're looking out at a Canadian football field full of grasslands. Underneath that, it's storing the emissions of 39 cars. Now, through the current, Canada grassland protocol to protect these grasslands, a farmer could be making, like your average landowner on the prairies could be looking at making somewhere between $15,000 and $60,000 a year by protecting their grasslands. So it's not an insignificant amount of money.
Does that apply to other carbon caches as well? Or is that something that only exists for the grasslands? And if it is, what do we need to do to take it across Canada's natural areas?
Yeah, so the federal government is actually in the process right now of designing what is called a protocol, which is basically a recipe for how these carbon credits are going to work on a federal level. So the federal government is looking at these different ecosystems, including forests and grasslands and wetlands and farmlands, to create a standard across the country. Now, there's a couple different kinds of carbon markets that you can sell these to. You were asking before about who's paying for this. So in the case of the grasslands protocol, that protocol right now is through what's called a voluntary carbon market. And that is basically meaning that, companies or individuals are choosing to buy carbon credits for one reason or another, to offset some of their emissions. It could be an individual wants to offset a flight. It could be a company has made a commitment to going carbon neutral, and now they're looking for how are they going to do that. So in that case, those carbon credits are being sold on that voluntary market. What the federal government is looking to do is to put the framework in place for more of what is called a regulatory market. And so that's where this is kind of the flip side of putting a cap on emissions. If you put a cap on emissions, it creates a market for emissions. And so once these systems are in place, then, you know, these types of credits would be able to be sold to really anybody and everybody who needs to keep their emissions lower, including governments.
I'd love to ask you right now about some of the areas that I honestly didn't know about and didn't really understand how much carbon was stored there. So I think we'd all assume that, you know, gigantic boreal forests can store a lot of carbon. But what about the peatlands on the far north of Ontario? One of these sources in one of your pieces said, people don't wake up and go, oh yeah, decomposing organic material is the best. And I had no idea that so much carbon was there.
Yeah, this is an area that I think a lot of people don't realize. You know, rainforests are kind of the sexy thing, and everybody talks about the Amazon rainforest and the carbon it sequesters. But the reality is that wetlands and peatlands store a tremendous amount of carbon. It's estimated that the peatlands in northern Ontario contain about 35 billion tons of carbon. That's equivalent to the annual emissions from 7 billion cars. And so just by being there and, you know, containing that decomposing organic matter that's been there for millions of years, they're keeping that carbon in the ground. Now, the challenge is that as we press further and further into natural areas, we start building roads, we start building mines. You know, these are proposals that are on the table right now for Northern Ontario in the so-called Ring of Fire region. Mm-hmm. That will carve up those peatlands and that will release a tremendous amount of carbon in the process.
How do we protect them? Do we pay people not to develop them the same way we do with the grasslands?
Yeah, that's essentially, you know, what this series is getting at. And, you know, certain protocols are further developed than others, but, you know, looking at actually putting a price on what an intact wetland or peatland is worth to our country and how it can help us meet our carbon goals is ultimately where this is all going. In the throne speech this year, the federal government talks about nature-based climate solutions. So the federal government is raising this as something that they're looking very seriously at. They're developing, you know, the carbon market protocols for this. And increasingly, I think we're going to see this as a way that we're going to be, you know, not just avoiding creating emissions, although that certainly needs to be part of the answer as well, but avoiding destroying natural ecosystems that store tremendous amounts of carbon.
What do we know about how to create more of these carbon caches? Everybody kind of understands plant trees and the Liberals made a big promise around that, but how do you create more peat bogs and wetlands and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So, you know, the commitment to plant trees tends to get, you know, quite a bit of criticism because, you know, it introduces this idea that you could be, say, cutting down old growth forest and just planting more new trees. And that's, you know, largely not seen as really being the solution. The good news in Canada is that we have a lot of intact ecosystems, but we are destroying them. And this is going to create more of an incentive to not destroy them. So there's so much that we can save. There are also areas that we can restore. So in our piece on blue carbon, we talked about how there's work now to restore salt marshes, for instance, around the Bay of Fundy, to actually reflood areas that have been drained previously. And you can bring those carbon ecosystems back into play. But right across the country, there are different ecosystems. You know, we did one piece looking at the Acadian Forest, which is, you know, a forest that doesn't get a lot of attention as well. And there are 80,000 family woodlot owners in the Maritimes who own, you know, chunks of this forest. And many of those people don't really want to clear cut it, right? And the forest on their land contains a huge amount of carbon. If they can earn revenue by not cutting down the forest, most people would much rather do that than to clear cut their land.
Here's the thing that I have trouble wrapping my head around when we talk about this is, how much of this discussion for nature-based climate solutions is about making the climate crisis better versus the actual acts we're talking about here, which is just like not doing stuff to natural areas, which is great, only seem to me at least to be about not making it worse rather than kind of increasing the amount of carbon we can store.
Yeah, so that really gets at like the fundamental question of like how carbon credits work. And for something to count as a carbon credit, it needs to be what's called like an additional thing. So to get a carbon credit for something, it needs to be because there was an actual threat to it being destroyed. So these aren't like fictional gains. You know, when we talk about not destroying something, it's to get a carbon credit, it's because it was actually under imminent threat of being destroyed. Like the Acadian forest is being cut down at quite a rate. And so if a landowner is in a position where they're going to either cut down that forest or they would choose not to, then that is a very real and tangible, you know, savings in terms of carbon. And the same thing, you know, you see that with farmers and, you know, ranchers as well. They're facing those tough choices every day to try to, you know, make a living in a business that gets harder and harder. And we're providing them with a tangible incentive not to destroy the land. And, you know, every day we are cutting down forests, we are converting grasslands, and we are destroying wetlands. And so we need to find a way to stop that. And while there's all sorts of altruistic reasons why you might argue to stop that, you know, those altruistic reasons haven't been that successful those so far. You know, we're still destroying these really valuable carbon landscapes at quite a pace.
That makes a lot of sense to me, but I still end up looking at the big picture, in which we need to drastically reduce emissions, not just leave them at the same level and make sure we leave the carbon where it's stored, right? So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how far can we take this in terms of making making a dent in reversing the damage that we've done? Or is this at its bottom line about sustaining what we've still got?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, you know, and the answer involves both. So we both need to actually reduce our real emissions, you know, being smarter in our oil and gas sector, having more efficient vehicles, having more efficient modes of transportation, all of those things that we hear about all the time. But this is a way, you know, to stop increasing our emissions through doing really, you know, quite silly things like cutting down intact forests for a short-term economic gain. And we're going to need both of those solutions to reach our climate targets and to turn this ship around.
Do we know bluntly how this polls? Is this a partisan issue? We've seen that. We've covered that repeatedly as it pertains to the carbon tax on this show. And it always ends up splitting down partisan lines. How does this poll?
You know, I don't know that there's a lot of research on that yet. It's quite a new concept, to be honest. I mean, I've been working on reporting on environmental issues for over 10 years, and I'd never really heard about this until this year. So it's something that's, you know, fairly fresh on the policy landscape here in Canada. I do think that one of the really exciting things about it, though, is that I think it holds the potential to sort of bridge the divide, because a lot of the people who we featured in this series, for instance, they're farmers, they're ranchers. They're not people who you would, you know, expect to be out, you know, rallying for Greenpeace. But it's really, it's showing the flip side of putting a price on carbon, right? It's not just that you now have to pay more for your, you know, tank of gas and all of those types of things. It's also that there's an actual price on carbon, which means that people who are managing carbon-rich landscapes can make an income from protecting those landscapes. So it kind of builds out the picture of what putting a price on ecosystem services, including carbon, really means in the fuller picture. And I think it can create buy-in, you know, from people, you know, like the Livestock Associations of Canada, you know, the Canadian Forage and Grasslands Association is working with landowners across Canada right now around carbon protocols. And so I think that's really reaching across the aisle in new and interesting ways.
You mentioned that this just popped up on your radar fairly recently, and obviously it just popped up on mine when we contacted you guys to do this week. How quickly has it gained momentum compared to some of the solutions you've seen floated in the past? The carbon tax, like we just mentioned, has taken years to take shape.
Yeah, I think it's gaining momentum quite quickly because it's seen as really being a bit of a win-win solution. Like I say, not only is it, you know, taking care of the carbon issue, but at the same time, it's helping Canada meet its conservation goals. So, you know, Indigenous protected and conserved areas have a huge role to play in this as well. If you look at, you know, Indigenous people who may want to protect vast swaths of their land, how do you finance that, right? Indigenous protected areas are great, but how do you create a financial incentive for those to be created? And looking at the value of the carbon on the landscape is one way that creates an avenue to do that. So I think there's a lot of interest from Indigenous people, from governments, from, you know, your traditional environmentalists and conservationists, as well as from people like farmers and ranchers. So I think it's exciting in the sense that it is bringing together a lot of unlikely characters.
That kind of taps into the last thing that I wanted to ask you about, and it's more of a big picture question. Based on the work we've done with you guys all this week and also on some stories we've done in the past on climate change, which is when a publication like yours, which delves into some of the more depressing aspects of the way our natural world is changing, stumbles across a project like this one, how does it change both the morale in your virtual office, but also just the way you approach your mission going forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, finding systemic solutions like this one, it becomes, you know, embedded in all of our reporting now as an angle to look at, you know, like, well, how much carbon is on that landscape? Let's check out the map and look at that element of that. And it's providing, you know, this kind of larger policy framework where conservation could actually move forward. And I know, you know, our reporters really enjoyed getting to work on something so hopeful and optimistic for once. And, you know, we take those morale boosts where we can get them these days.
Emma, thank you so much for walking us through this. Thank you for making your reporters and their work available to us all week. We've really appreciated it. Let's do it again sometime, and hopefully we'll have even more hopeful stories when we do.
We'll work on it. Thanks so much for having us.
Emma Gilchrist, Editor-in-Chief of The Narwhal, and a special heartfelt thank you to those journalists for the work they do every day. It's important stuff. We're glad you stuck with us to hear about it. You can find them at thenarwhal.ca, NARWHAL.ca, and you can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can talk to us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. You can hit us up on email, thebigstorypodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. And if you liked this week, leave us a review in your podcast app of choice, unless it doesn't let you, in which case go to a podcast app you like less that does let you leave a review and leave one there. Claire Brassard, Stephanie Phillips, and Ryan Clark produced The Big Story. Annalisa Nielsen is our digital editor. From all of us and from the team at Frequency, have a great weekend. We'll talk Monday.